July 29th, 1990. Dr. Robin Myers, The Odd Couple.
It's good to be back here inside this room where you know and I know that some of the finest, purest light captured in any sanctuary in Christendom is to be found. I see that God has succeeded in keeping a pipe organ out of this place. No. There's no politics intended here. I'm just being observant. It may be a non-instrumental Church of Christ curse, as God looked down and saw Bob Myers and Bob Scott in the same room and said, "No pipe organ in there." Speaking of my mom and dad, they are off to Switzerland this afternoon. I think that's great. I think that's what you should do as you mature. The most amazing thing about the trip is not that my father has agreed to fly over water, no less, but that my mother has gotten 2 weeks' worth of her flamboyant wardrobe into one 26-inch suitcase. And they say miracles have ceased. I asked my dad if I could preach this morning. I enjoy doing it and nowhere more than here. This weekend, my family left the cabin in Colorado to drive home so I could attend my 20th high school reunion, North High reunion, and it's been fun. It might comprise a sermon in and of itself someday, but not yet. I got back and to sleep at 2 o'clock this morning, so if I seem a little woozy, that's the reason. I want to talk about one of the Bible's oddest couples, Hosea and Gomer. Not your average suburban mom and pop by any means. First of all, Hosea claims that God instructed him to marry a prostitute and then write about it. And when you think about it, such a marriage would certainly give you a lot to write about. Like, for starters, why would you do it? Well, the opening lines of the book of Hosea offer this explanation. The Lord said to Hosea, "Go take to yourself a wife of harlotry, and have children of harlotry, for the land commits great harlotry by forsaking the Lord." Lots of harlotry in there. So he went and took Gomer, the daughter of Diblaim, or a worthless woman, and she conceived and bore him a son. Now, first of all, ladies, if you had a name like Gomer, you might very well take to the streets yourself. This is not the most feminine, ethereal name I can think of for a little girl. And since people usually end up looking exactly like their names, I can only imagine that Gomer was not a 10. A little heavy with the lipstick, maybe a little less than choosy about men and booze, a little loud, but great at a party and always good for a laugh. This was Hosea's wife. And it could be that the real story is he just had a thing for her and wanted to make her an honest woman, and so he stretched that prophetic imagination of his a bit, and sure enough, he found a message from God in his ear, justifying the marriage and providing a marvelous metaphor for his disgust with the nation of Israel. That's fine, as far as I'm concerned, but it is not so cool what he did to his kids. As you know, he gave each of them a weird name that indicated also how mad God was at his chosen people, names that translated into things like "not pitied" and "not my people," so that, bless their hearts, each time the roll was called at school, Hosea could score a prophetic bullseye in absentia. You hear the rabbi calling a name that means "not pitied"? It's "not pitied" here. Yes, I'm here. Yes. Oh, yes, Hosea's kid. Having a father who is a prophet is not all it's cracked up to be. How were they supposed to know he would end up with his own book in the Bible? All they know is he's married to a whore who is not visible at any PTA functions, and he was asked once and only once to speak at assembly. Too negative, they said. People just didn't feel inspired. Garrison Keillor said once, "It is one thing for a prophet to go to his martyrdom alone. It is quite another for him to drag his whole family along." But you know what? He loved Gomer. He must have. If you can get past those names, I suppose he loved his kids too. Because although she settled down for a while after the wedding, sort of basking in the glow of the settled, decent life, it wasn't long before he hit the sawdust trail again and Gomer hit the bars. He would come home still wrapped in that sandwich board sign that said, "The end is at hand" on one side and "Watch out" on the other. And she would come home drunk and smelling like somebody else's aftershave. And a rather formidable silence descended between them. Every time he raised his hand to her, she burst into tears. Every time she raised one to him, he was the one who ended up apologizing. And this went on, and as you might expect, Hosea began to wonder what possessed him to marry this woman. You know how it goes. Everyone says, "I'll change him. I'll straighten her up. My love will take the place of that bottle." And Hosea is getting, frankly, tired of seeing other men in town looking at him with that peculiar mixture of pity and contempt. His latest batch of kids don't look anything like him. And so finally, in a rage, he decides to lock her out of the house. This is all in the Bible. You may have a renewed interest in reading it. He will no longer get up at 4 o'clock in the morning, open the door, and supervise her passing out. I mean, Hosea thought to himself, who is the whore in this house anyway? And then one day she didn't show up at all. And he swore this time he was through with her for keeps, but of course he wasn't. When he found her, she was lying passed out in some highly specialized establishment above an adult bookstore, and he had to pay the management plenty to let her out of her contract. She'd lost her front teeth and picked up some scars you'd have to see to believe. But Hosea had her back again, and that's all that seemed to matter. Now, this sounds crazy, and it was. But Hosea had a point to make. And it couldn't be made just by babbling. Talk is cheap. But when you walk down the street holding hands with Gomer and you preach, well, people listen. If for no other reason than that they are curious. And they listen to Hosea's sermon, which, if you want to get to the heart of the matter, is captured in a single line. The Lord has a controversy with the inhabitants of the land. Put more colloquially, a la Eddie, God was mad as hell at Israel and not going to take it anymore. There was no truth, no mercy. Instead, lying, killing, stealing, committing adultery. And I know what you're thinking. It sounds like the evening news. In fact, I would insult you if I started listing the comparisons because you can fill in blanks as easily as I can. Sooner or later, you and I, all of us, must ascertain that painful distance between rhetoric and reality in our time. Because we are as red, white, and blue as a 4th of July picnic and as publicly virtuous as a revivalist. But underneath something else is going on. Underneath, something is not so good. One of the best things for me about being on vacation in Colorado is reading the Denver Post. Where I come from, we don't have a decent newspaper. And they've been following quite closely the Silverado SNL debacle, a particularly juicy chapter in the national tragedy. And one of the Thrift's directors, a Mr. Walters, who recently testified before Congress that he was broke, his words exactly were, "I have a negative net worth," I think that means you're broke, was found this week to be luxuriating in his $1.5 million California home, where his wife had also bought Malibu beachfront property, and his family, by hiding their assets in various trust funds, had also purchased a home in the desert of Palm Springs. Now, I'm not trying to just grab headlines and say, isn't it awful? I am preaching from a text about public hypocrisy and private corruption, and I don't have to tell you how true it rings. When Imelda Marcos got down on her knees in the Cathedral of St. John the Divine in New York City and thanked God for the American judicial system, I must admit it made me nauseous. For all our public posturing, we are not winning the war on drugs, maybe somewhere else, but not in Wichita, and race relations are not so good. If you remember Watts and Newark and Detroit, it's kind of like walking around in a circle. And to make matters worse, the blacks in this country are now being victimized by the hate-mongering rhetoric of a new generation of black leaders, real frightening scumbags like the Reverend Al Sharpton and Louis Farrakhan and the ever-crusading Tawanda Brawley, who campaigned against imaginary rapists in a world where there are enough real ones. These nihilists have forgotten the dream of Dr. Martin Luther King and are calling not for an embrace of American values, fairness, and an end to prejudice, but for a war against the white race. Not all who call me Lord, Lord, says Jesus, are necessarily going to make it into the kingdom. And that means, to me at least, that you don't have to be a headliner to be a hypocrite. You can wear a wedding ring and call yourself Mrs., get your picture in all the right papers, and still be a harlot. Or, since it takes two to make a prostitute, gentlemen, you can be a paragon of civic virtue. You can rail against everything from big government to welfare and work to purge the schools of secular humanism or any other creeping ism, and still be a John, keeping all the Gomers in the world in business and testing all the patience of every Hosea. I don't know which is worse sometimes, the prophet's tendency to jump up and down and scream foul, or our tendency to pretend it isn't so. There can be, as you know, a kind of delicious condescension in the voice of the mad prophet decrying the hypocrisies of our time. Woe is us, woe is us, woe is us, oh, go home. But in the matter of public virtue, private corruption, sometimes one needs to stop and consider the truth. Sometimes the louder we get, the more we pat ourselves on the back, the more incessantly we remind ourselves how virtuous, how patriotic, how moral we are, the less we can lay claim to any of these things. Psychologists call it denial. And when the problems get really big, and threaten to overwhelm us, that's when we raise it to a national art form. That's what Hosea said. There is no faithfulness or kindness, no knowledge of God in the land. There is swearing, lying, killing, stealing, and committing adultery. They break all bounds, and murder follows murder. I live in probably the most churched city in America. I think Oklahoma City has more churches than any place I've ever been. It is in the heart of born-again conservatism. It is the Bible Belt. And so far, all I can see it doing is holding up the trousers of hypocrisy. Oklahoma has more public piety and yet more tragic social statistics than just about any state in the nation. We have the fourth highest teen pregnancy rate, but we fight constantly against sex education in the schools. We have one of the highest national illiteracy rates in a state with the worst teacher salaries. We have one of the highest drug dependency rates per capita, and Oklahoma is one of the worst places to stay married statistically or grow up in a home where you can escape being beaten or molested. I read with some amusement a commentary from 1945 written about this passage on Hosea about the dangerous moral decline of our society. I think you'll find it charming and rather quaint. Quote, certain tendencies in the national life, this is 1945, indicate the weakening of moral fiber. The FBI places the annual crime bill of the U.S. at between $5 and $7 billion. The gambling racket is vitiating the morals of millions of people. In 1944, when American soldiers and sailors were fighting for freedom, paid admission to racetracks reached, $2 million. and $1 billion was wagered through parimutuel machines. Add to this $2 billion in illegal bets, this was before Pete Rose, placed over the telephone and in stores, this was before state-run lotteries. The money involved in these gambling transactions each year is more than 100 times greater than the sum contributed by all Christians of the West for the expansion of the missionary movement around the world. Gambling has become a national disease. Quote, this Baptist preacher, I'm sure, "The man who gambles and wins is a thief. The man who gambles and loses is a fool. Now take your choice." Well, that sounds like Elmer Gantry or Billy Sunday, and yet those numbers are quaint by today's standards, and so are the social problems. So you have a right about now in the sermon to say, okay, 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 enough already. Mr. Preacher, why don't you give us some good news? Where is the good news? Well, my answer comes from exactly where you would expect it to come from. Hosea took a prostitute for a wife in order to make a point about how it must feel to be God married to us. And for some unexplainable reason, no matter how many times we come home at 5 a.m. and pass out, he tucks us in. No matter how late we stay out, no matter how much damage we do, he leaves the light on. We talk all the time about God being love. God is love, and that's a lovely idea, but sometimes I think it must be patience. God is patience, because if it were not that way, he would have given up a long time ago. And it seems to me that he has made a world both consequential and a candidate for redemption. We suffer for what we do, but the light is always on, like a parent to a wayward child, like the father of the prodigal son, like Hosea to Gomer. What limit is there to God's love? And what more powerful definition of love than limitless patience? I knew this woman once who was full of joy just at being alive, though her health was not good. I visited her once and she was having trouble with her leg. And she told me about it, but she was rather nonchalant. She did not descend into self-pity, world without end, but she talked about this problem she had as if it were an annoyance, nothing more. After all, she said, it's just a leg. Her plans that day included shopping for a gift for a new grandchild, writing some notes to a friend, and visiting a child in the hospital. "What about your leg?" I said. "Oh," she said, "I'll just drag the damn thing along." God must feel that way about creation sometimes. He neither spares us the pain of living what we deserve and don't deserve, nor does he withhold the love that makes life itself possible. And like prophets, we can never be sure whether he is more angry than patient or more patient than angry. But one thing we know for sure, both the anger and the patience are born of a love so deep that we cannot fathom it, just as we cannot fathom Hosea's devotion to Gomer. And when you think about it, our whole faith is unfathomable. For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that they who believe in him should not perish but have everlasting life. Hosea started out his career with a sandwich board that said, "The end is at hand on one side and watch out on the other." But by and by, he changed the sign. After a few years with Sweet Gomer, he painted over the old words, and he put some new words in their place. On one side, he wrote, "God is love," and on the other side, he wrote, "There's no end to it." Well, people still thought he was crazy, but nobody laughed at him. As for Gomer, she still hits the bars, but less often these days. And whenever someone starts putting Hosea down, she can often be heard defending him. Once, she even told a former customer right in his face, "Watch what you say. That's my husband. you're talking about.